now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Mars.
See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. From class, the cult, on the cheese in between, the movie or beef, entertainment is grade A. And I'm your host, Mr. Jason Giaconetti, and I'm joined again by my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
How you doing, Jay? Today, I think we've got a bit of an anomaly from Hammer Films, the 1970 Vampire Lovers.
Yep, and we'll get to it right after this.
Come with us, if you dare, into a twilight world of unspeakable horror.
You must die. Everybody must die.
Sample, if you dare, the deadly passion of the vampire lovers. The vampire lovers. Perverted creatures of the night find their victims everywhere. The unsuspecting merrymakers in glittering ballrooms with their young and tender throats. The sleeping beauties whose troubled dreams turn into real, terrifying nightmares.
There was a cat! A huge cat!
For God's sake, save her!
Till their evil hearts are still for all eternity. If one remains, yes, even one, there will be thousands more. Beware. Beware the cold caress, the kiss that kills. Beware the vampire lovers.
The Vampire Lovers was released October 4th, 1970, with a 91-minute running time by Hammer Films. It is considered to be part of the unofficial Karenstein trilogy. It's the first movie there, the second being Lust of a Vampire, 1971, and Twins of Evil, 1972. Your director is Roy Ward Baker. Now, he also directed Scars of Dracula in 1970. He had directed Asylum in 1972, Vault of Horror in 1973, and Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde in 71. Of course, Vault of Horror and The Asylum are Amicus movies, and Scars of Dracula is part of the Dracula ones, and right. Then Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde's Hammer is Hammer as well. What you'll notice here as we go through, and Dad and I, again, this is the February edition, so this is the one where we try to find, you know, something a little different, maybe a love movie kind of thing, where it's always a little offbeat. This movie is very different than a lot of the other things we're going to talk about normally when we talk about films. So your main star, of course, is the late Ingrid Pitt. Ingrid Pitt, she didn't make a lot of films. People think she made a lot of films. She really didn't. She's noted for, obviously, being beautiful. And in this movie, you see all of her. She was Countess Dracula in 1971. She was in the House That Dripped Blood in 1971, where she plays a vampire again. And she's actually in The Wicker Man in 73. But I didn't know this. She was in Dr. Zhivago in 1965, uncredited, and she was. And so, but, you know, she was really young, real young, right? Peter Cushing, of course, is here. He's only in the film for a short amount of time, the beginning and the end. An absolute Hammer staple. I mean, Peter Cushing, we can do hours on just him alone. Douglas Wilmer is the other face you might recognize here. He's King Pelias from Jason the Argonauts in 63. He was also in A Shot in the Dark in 64, Golden Voyage of Sinbad in 74, Brides of Fu Manchu 66, and Vengeance of Fu Manchu 67, and of course, An Octopussy in 83. But he's actually best known as Sherlock Holmes from the BBC TV series. It was 12 episodes. He had played him in a TV movie miniseries. BBC is kind of different how they do things. It's not really movies.
Right.
But he was very famous for being Sherlock Holmes. And then he came back to play him in the 12 episodes later in the series, and then came back and played Sherlock Holmes or Sherlock Holmes type roles in certain things. And he's considered to be the definitive Sherlock Holmes for the BBC. He's in their Broadcasting Hall of Fame. He is known as the Sherlock Holmes. He is the standard by which everyone puts it up here. Again, not something we're familiar with being, in America, because I've never seen any of those. When I think Sherlock Holmes, I'm thinking Basil Rathbone and things like that.
Yeah.
Whereas in England, obviously, it was Douglas Wilmer.
So. Yeah. We don't get to see them unless you see some of the shows on PBS.
Yeah.
In New York here, it's Channel 13. But, most of the time on PBS, or at least for myself, we watch the concerts and things like mm-hmm. that. But a series like that, probably not.
But it was also back. We're talking in the 60s and 70s kind of thing.
The thing with PBS now is that they have retrospectives and they bring these shows back.
Sure. But I'm saying, it was only 12 episodes and it was other things that went with it. But again, he is known as the definitive Sherlock Holmes, which was something I didn't know. And at least, I learned something doing this. This was actually distributed by AIP here in the States, which is not surprising because this was a movie they were able to get the cheap, and a lot of the Hammer films were done that way. AIP putting them out here in the States, of course, with Hammer Films production being your main production company. All right, so and again, like I said, this is based on the Countess Karenstein idea. This is why these movies are so vastly different. The three of these films, obviously. Lust of a Vampire and Twins of Evil being the two sequels to The Vampire Lovers, it is not your typical Dracula vampire movie. And I think when we start talking about this, you're going to notice this is a very short little write-up we have here. There's not a ton in the middle because it's a lot of the same repetitive stuff. So I didn't want anyone to feel like, hey, you guys are jipping this. It's just what it is. But because it's not a Dracula story.
I mean, when watching the movie, again, I hadn't seen this movie probably in 30 years.
Yeah.
And the opening, I thought with the atmospheric opening, it was great.
Yeah.
And then it just morphs into what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the main differences is that this movie is remembered a different way. Some people are like, oh, I remember this.
Yeah.
And it was a problem. I had the same problem. I misremembered this because I was remembering Countess Dracula, which has a lot more story to it than this movie. But it's okay. It's not, we're not bad-mouthing. I'm just saying is when we start talking about it, you're like, huh, I seem to remember this, and this happening. You got to go back. It's some of the misrememberings that we talk about a lot of times with these older films that maybe you haven't seen 6 and 7 and 8 times. I know I've seen this now twice because I only ever seen this movie once before this, and I saw it now. So in the early 19th century in Styria, a beautiful blonde, which is played by Kristen Lodham, is in a gown. Materials are from a misty grave. And this is what Dad's talking about. The opening of this movie opens up and we have this being coming out of the ground. We're like, okay. And so she's encountered by Baron Hartog, which is Douglas Wilmer, who's a vampire hunter out to avenge the death of his sister. And the girl identifies as a vampire and she's decapitated. This is the opening 8 minutes of this movie. You're like, all right, this is a movie. Like, kind of thing. This is starting to start going. So then we cut to many years later. right? Or we don't know how many years, but it's definitely sometime later.
Yeah, it can't be that much longer.
Not years
maybe,
and years.
Maybe 5, 10.
Yeah, we're talking like a number of years later, but not like, you know, decades later.
No.
But some time has to pass. And we get a dark-haired lady leaving her daughter, Marcilla, who is Ingrid Pitt, in the care of General Spindorf, which is Peter Cushing and his family in Styria. And now she's at a party. And the great part about this is when Ingrid Pitt walks in, of course, every single head in the room turns because, you know, she's a vampire, which we don't know. I mean, we know that, but we don't know that yet. But every single head in the room turns, of course, except the one young man who was with the girl. And it becomes this story that we're like, okay, it seems like there was a weird, the opening doesn't seem to match up with this. And like, oh, he's a general. Maybe he's like a witch hunter or a vampire hunter. And maybe this is where they're going. But it's you'll see. So Marcilla is left in is left with the general because the dark-haired woman, we don't really know anything about her. She feigns that she has to go take care of her dying or dead brother, right? And she wants to leave her daughter there, right? So Marcilla quickly becomes friends with the general's niece, which is Laura, which is played by Piper Steele, and no relation to Barbara Steele, anything like that. And Laura subsequently suffers from these nightmares. She's being attacked by a giant cat.
Yeah, not a wolf or a bat.
Right, a cat.
A cat.
But the cat, in every dream, turns into Marcilla.
Right.
And then Marcilla's there to comfort her. So what happens is, this goes on. And you're like, okay. So you're like, all right. So she's being attacked by this cat in the dream. But she's getting weaker and weaker. And we know what that means. It's just being drained of her blood. And she eventually dies from a gradual sickness. Whereupon Marcilla just disappears.
Right.
Right?
Like, yeah. And as I, you know, as we're watching this thing unfold, I mean, it doesn't happen quickly. She gets weaker and weaker day after day after day.
Which is a lot like a Dracula story. Like in the Dracula movies, like Mina's getting weaker.
Yes.
But there's stuff happening.
Yeah. Right. This is just the same scene
over and over again.
And so my take was it's a cat. Was she bitten? Oh, she must have been.
Right.
Because there are bite marks, not on her neck.
On her breast.
On her breast.
Yeah. Well, but that's also playing up the Countess Karenstein aspect of it. And that's what we're going to talk about. Because this is why these movies are very famous. The problem becomes, it kind of seems like, okay, fine. So you're like, okay, great. His niece is dead. Now we're going to have Cushing is going to go hunt this woman down. Because she's gone, right? Because that makes perfect sense. Right here, you're like, he's going to start hunting her down. Because now he's going to be the vampire hunter. And maybe he's going to hook up with this other vampire hunter. And they're going to trick. Nope. So what happens is now we cut to a faking of a carriage breaking down and Marcilla's mom, who's the exact same lady, and Marcilla, who is the exact same person, doesn't look any different, now using the name Carmilla, because that's a big switch right there, the M to the C, right? Becomes Mr. Morton, who is friends with the general, comes upon them on the road and he says, no, you must come back. And she's like, no, I have to go on. Can you take my daughter back with you? And of course he does. Now the problem is Carmilla now befriends and seduces Morton's daughter, Emma. Emma's best friend just died. Emma's best friend was Laura.
Right.
But they never at any point figure out they're the exact same person. Now I understand that Laura's at the party and Marcilla is kind of like, she disappears for a little bit, whatever. But you would think Laura, your best friend, might mention to you, have you seen this lady who looks totally different than everybody else
right now
at this party? So, which that to me kind of threw me.
Yeah. And now, and right at this point.
And it's not like we're talking about like, this is like 2 years later. This is right after.
It's like a week.
Not even a week. She's barely dead. That's how she was. My friend died last week.
Yeah.
Like her best friend just died.
And this is where the repetitiveness begins. I mean, it's almost scene for scene and words for words. One of the things that I forgot to mention was the original Peter Cushing's daughter or niece. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The word scream queen, she yells out or she screams.
Oh, yeah. Three or four
but to the point where it almost hurts your ears.
Yeah, well, she's doing her job. That's what her job is.
But I'm saying, but this movie has got like three or four, you know, scream queens.
Yeah, right. So, so thereafter, Emma starts suffering nightmares of penetration of her heart, and her breasts show tiny wounds again.
Right.
And again, this is playing up the lesbianism. And there's a lot of lesbianism throughout the film, and this is very controversial in 1970. This was the Karenstein trilogy is all about lesbianism. Well, since I've it involves a lot of lesbianism, and that's why those books have been redone over and over and over again, because they are redone in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, right now, and they redo these same things. Okay, folks, gotta give me 1 second right here. And we're back. So, as we were saying, so she's got these wounds in her breast, and we're talking about the idea of the lesbianism and stuff, and it keeps coming up over and over, and the Karenstein trilogy has been done in numerous different ways by, like, Roger Corman and Full Moon and whatever. It's like the low-end stuff. It's been done on high-end stuff, and let's be honest, things like Anne Rice and stuff like that. I mean, she owes, as much as it might, that's not the same. And I'm not saying Anne Rice is exactly the same, because there'll be somebody who'll write in, right. It's not the same thing. But you definitely see the Karenstein trilogy showing up in her books and like those writings and True Blood and all this vampire stuff that's out there. A lot of that stuff has to deal with that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, to me, at this point, I mean, I'm saying in the back of my mind that this is really going down a different path. And now, at this point, with the second victim, again, it's another cat nightmare, not bat or a wolf.
Yeah,
we got R-rated nudity coming in here.
Yeah,
well, I mean, yeah. but this is out of nowhere. All of a sudden, I mean, you can think that it's going to happen, but bingo.
Yeah, well, but this is what Hammer did. This is post. Horror, Dracula, Curse of Frankenstein, those things.
Well, yeah.
This is when Hammer started putting a lot of nude women in movies, and they knew that's how they were selling their movies through.
Yeah, but again, in the early Hammer movies, there was a lot of low cut gowns.
Yes,
so
right.
So a lot of that titillation.
Yeah.
that you get to see here. Bingo.
Yeah. Well, Ingrid Pitt's butt.
Well, now we're at 42nd Street.
I mean, Ingrid Pitt gets out of the bathtub. She is buck naked. I mean, you don't. I mean, you see everything on her. There's and all the other women there, you're definitely seeing all their breasts the entire time. But that's what Hammer was doing. They knew they could sell sex that way. And to be honest, that's really what Hammer started doing. And that's one of the downfalls of Hammer, was that Hammer, all the movies, if you look at their earlier films, and again, you can like these films, that's not the issue. When you look at like Horror Dracula, Curse of Frankenstein, Frankenstein's Revenge, right. Or Revenge of Frankenstein, Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, they're all about the story. It's the story. It's the story. It's the story. And it's the creatures and it's the makeup. And then they're like, well, we can put naked women in them. And you started having naked women along with these stories. And they're like, we can kind of tone down the story and more naked women.
Well, toning down the story is one thing. Almost eliminating it completely.
Right. But I'm saying is, but that's what I think. This is why when you read the Hammer retrospectives and stuff, when you start getting the change in Hammer from those movies where it was a lot more story, they just weren't selling as well, but the nudity was selling. And they knew they could sell this through. Again, Dad, it's just the change that would happen. It's not. I'm not saying it's a good change. It's a change that did happen. All right.
What we haven't talked about here, there's in the opening, not the opening sequence, but when we first meet Peter Cushing at the party.
Oh, yeah.
There's a guy on a horse, some distance away, watching all of this.
Right.
And he is repeated 3 or 4 times. But he's never explained.
Yeah.
Now, is he the pimp?
No, Dad.
What?
No. That's what I'm saying. I'm going to talk about that.
Okay.
The whole point is that he represents the vampire part of this. That's how you know they're vampires.
Yeah. Well, again, okay.
Right. But that's how you're supposed to know they're vampires, right? Because he's whatever. But he's also the coachman driving the thing. He has other parts in there. He's part of this whole thing. That's what they talk about in the beginning. So anyway, so what happens now is we have Emma's governess, Mademoiselle Pardot, who also now falls under Carmilla's trance. And now she becomes a victim of Carmilla. So now Carmilla's got Emma, who is being drained, and now she's also draining the countenance. And the problem is, as the butler and the doctor are the butler seems to suspect something, and he doesn't really want, Carmilla can't get him under his trance at first, but he wants to bring a doctor in to help Emma, but now the governess doesn't want that. So what happens is now Ingrid Pitt, Carmilla seduces him.
Right, but the governess is also falling under...
That's what I'm saying. She already is. Yeah, she's already being... But she's being drained as well. She's having her blood drained too. So she's falling weaker. She can't stand... Now, because they probably put the garlic in there. She can't stand the smell. It's all the different vampire things we normally deal with, right? And now she can't handle. So now you have. So the butler's trying to do this. So what happens is Carmilla then's like, "Well, I'll have to seduce him," and she does, and she gets him to fall under the spell. So he's now being complicit. The doctor comes in, and the doctor can't. The doctor's like, well, I got to get, he's going to go get help. And what happens is Carmella attacks him and kills him.
Yeah. But right? The doctor, and I think it's what happens, the doctor has his suspicions early on when he sees the bite marks. And then I think I put it down that the doctor actually knows.
Yeah, he knows it's a vampire.
I mean, he knows that it's vampire.
Right. But he didn't want to admit it's a vampire, but they said, okay, you can leave the garlic, you can leave this.
Right.
And what happens is then he's then killed. So now we get back to the point where we have, back at the house now, Mademoiselle Parzano begs Carmilla to take her away because now Carmilla is going to take Emma away from all this. She wants to take Emma and leave. And of course, Carmilla then kills Pardot because she doesn't need her. She's useless. So now we have Carl, who's the young man who's supposed to look in on Emma, right? And he's coming back now. He's coming to there to look in on her. And that's when he walks in and he's absolutely useless. He's just useless because he knows she's a vampire, right? But his entire thing is I'm going to pull a sword on her, right? Not a cross. Not let me try something that actually might work. Let me pull a sword on her. So he gets there and there's Emma, and Emma starts praying to God, right? To like protect her soul because now she now knows there's something wrong, right? Carmella nearly kills Carl, right? Carl pulls his dagger out of his boot, which looks enough like a cross to make her pull away. But he waits until she starts dematerializing and then breaks the vase for no reason. He throws it at her. Throw it at her early, dude. Hit her with it, man. Do something because he has a sword in his hand and does nothing with it. Doesn't strike at her. What is he afraid? He's going to kill her? You just saw her murder somebody.
Yeah.
Put it in her. We worry about Emma being like, no, she shouldn't have been killed.
Yeah.
Kill her.
Yeah. This is the scene where, again, it breaks tradition. Camilla's reflection in the mirror is there.
Camilla's also able to go out in the daylight. She just can't be in direct sunlight. The rules of vampirism are not followed here.
Right.
They are kind of followed, but not really followed. They're followed when they're useful, but not followed when they're followed the whole time. Right? Emma's rescued, of course, and then Camilla flees to her ancestral castle, which is now obviously in ruins. The arrival now of the general who brings the now Baron Hartog, who's now obviously older because he's, they find Camilla's grave. They're searching for Camilla's grave.
Right. And Hartog recounts the story
of what happened,
of how he had killed or he had beheaded, the previous one.
Right. So now he reveals that her name is really Marcilla Karenstein, when the general then forces a stake into her heart because you now have Morton who is praying for Emma's life. But as the general says, my niece is already dead. I don't have to worry about praying for anyone's life. He's just going to kill her, right? And they jam it into her. And then the most famous scene from the entire movie is he pulls up Ingrid Pitt and he cuts her head off. And that is the most famous scene from this entire film by way of iconic scenes, which it's Peter Cushing holding, obviously Ingrid Pitt's, a severed head of Ingrid Pitt with blood coming out of it. And that's the scene that if you see any scenes from this film, that's the scene they always show besides the poster.
And that's what you remember from the movie. The opening 5 minutes and the last
five, ten minutes
are the movie.
And then, of course, when that happens, Camilla's portrait on the wall shows a fanged skeleton instead of a beautiful young woman.
Right.
We go to credits and we're done. And that's the movie. And I know you're saying, well, that's a pretty quick, summary, guys. Usually you guys, but there's not much more to tell. Like, there's not much more happening here. The thing is, obviously, this was shot in, it was actually shot in the Moor Park Mansion in Herefordshire, which stood in, obviously, for Central Europe and stuff like that. Like, we can talk all about those things. The main problem here, and I shouldn't say problem, is that, this movie, again, being, it was not looked at favorably. It wasn't like this was like Hammer had put out some movies that had gotten pretty good, critical review. This was looked at as like, what are they doing?
Right.
And it was a disappointment. And that they made two more. Now, to be honest, Lust of a Vampire and Twins of Evil have way more going on in them than this movie does, right? By way of vampirism. But there's still a lot of lesbianism, there's a lot of killing, but there's a lot of other vampires involved. And then also Vampire Circus and things like that. So other ones that are not officially part of this, like Countess Dracula, this was kind of like they did a test run. It was not enough so they amp things up.
Right.
So that's when Hammer started just splashing the blood all around. This does not have blood wall to wall. There's not a lot of gore. There's very little blood, period, in the whole movie.
Yeah, just the two severed heads.
Yeah, and that's it. And even the vampires and the biting, the wounds aren't gushing blood. There's no tearing of necks. There's none of that stuff. And there's certainly not a lot of, like, vampiric violence in the movie, kind of thing. Like, put it that way. Now, I put not nearly a vampiric action that you might hope for. It's sold on all on sex appeal, lots of naked breasts, and they were pushing the limits of the time for the lesbianism during the thing.
Right. Now, after watching this movie, I said, this movie was done. The premise of this movie was done a lot better in 1935. Dracula's daughter.
Yes.
I mean, all the lesbianism was implied, but not overt like it is here.
Yeah.
And then I went back and I watched Dracula's daughter again, and I realized if you're going to make an atmospheric vampire movie about women, that was the way to go.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that movie is, not, when you think about all the Dracula movies in the 30s, that one is not on everybody's, we got to watch it list. But if you see this movie, you've got to watch that one to understand how it could be done a lot better.
Right. Yeah. So, and again, we're not trying to, you know, again, if you like this movie, great. We'd love to hear from you, you know, kind of thing. Cause there's not enough here to me, to make this worth a movie that I can say, yes, I want to watch this again. I watched it once and I misremembered it as a lot of being Countess Dracula or maybe some of the other films, but it really does not hold up nearly as well, I think, as this reputation might hold it up as there. And again, you might not agree with us, and that's fine. But again, it's just, personally speaking, this is not one that I would watch again. I would much rather watch Countess Dracula over this. Or like Dad said, Dracula's Daughter, which is a far superior film, just filmmaking-wise. So if you're interested in picking this up, though, and it is available, I do have it on Blu-ray. It's about $9.99 right now on Blu-ray. The transfer of Blu-ray is beautiful, crisp, really good colors, very bright and vibrant. I also have, it's part of the Monsters for You horror set. It's part of with the vampire, the bat people, and the screaming skull. And the vampire is a really weird, different vampire movie than, you know, it's not really normal, right? The bat people kind of is in the title. And the screaming skull might be the best transfer of the screaming skull I've ever seen. It is crystal clean. And that goes for about $5.99. Now, the old Midnight Movies double release, which was Countess Dracula and Vampire Lovers, there's no point in spending the $20, $30 that's going to run you. Because, to be honest with you, you can get Countess Dracula for way cheaper than that by itself also. The Blu-ray of Countess Dracula is cheaper than the two of those together. So, if something you want, go over to the Two True Freaks website, click on the Amazon link, of course. That would help keep the lights on here and help us keep doing this show for you guys. Now, the other thing is, obviously, if you're interested in some of the other movies in this series, they are also available. Lust for a Vampire, Twins of Evil, Vampire Circus, Countess Dracula, those all fall in the same vein. If you're interested in this kind of stuff, look them up. And again, they feature beautiful women because that's what Hammer knew they could do. They were putting beautiful women in movies. And, you know, if they can agree to them, have them not have a whole lot of clothes on, that's how they sold this stuff through. Yeah. And again, if this is something you love, we'd love to hear from you because your feedback's important to us. And again, just because Dad and I didn't love this film doesn't mean it can't be one of your favorites. I know there are people who love movies that we don't, and there are movies that we love that people are like, how could you even, I can't even stomach watching that movie.
Right.
That's okay. It's not a problem. But speaking of email, we do have one email that came in, and this is from my brother, and it's about The Blob. So it says, Jay, I remember seeing The Blob 88 quite a bit on HBO during its run on pay cable, and there was a time when it would crop up on TBS and TNT a fair amount, which is true. It definitely would show up. It plays pretty well on the small screen since it doesn't really rely on widescreen spectacle. The film is gruesome and crazy, so well suited to monster crazy kids like me, that audience is also less likely to be bothered by plot details and are more likely to eat up the whole adults don't distrust kids angle. I have to suspect that the film was aimed at a teenage and geek show audience, so that sentiment seems to make sense, which is true. We talked about that. The remake of The Blob, again, not super heavy. Again, not that the original Blob was super heavy on story either, but it wasn't like, oh my God, but then they get 180. Now the government's involved and now it's all conspiracy. Yeah. But again, it's all, like Luke said, it's all based on the effects. And Chuck Russell was making a movie to make, it was not made to be like, he wasn't trying to win an Academy Award. Chuck Russell was making movies to make money. I mean, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is a perfect example. As much as I love Nightmare on Elm Street 3, It is not a critically acclaimed movie, and it's good, and you want to watch it, and it's enjoyable. Been more than a decade since I've watched this film, but it's a hard sell. In my house. So I was glad to hear you guys thought about it, and looking forward to Christmas special and any other surprises waiting in the darkness. Of course, Luke sent this in right before, right after the thing was done. Luke, P.S. Many times you remind me of things from our childhood, which I do not, but have one ridiculous memory tangentially connected to this film. The first we watched this movie afterwards, Dad sat us down at the kitchen table to fill us in the forms of our G.I. Joe Steel Brigade. Go Joe. We filled out our Steel Brigade form. Luke has, and again, Luke's actual thing says, and remember, beware of the blob should always be beware of the blob should always be spoken to the tune of Feliz Navidad, which is something I do all the time. Yeah. Beware of the blob. It has nothing to do with this. It's just funny. But yeah, that's one of those things Luke always says. He goes, I have memories hooked to different things. And it's weird little memories like that, you know, doing the Steel Brigade for G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just filling out a form and mailing it off and waiting 6 to 8 weeks for them to mail back a generic figure that has nothing to do with what we filled in. It's like you sent us the same generic figure that everyone else got with the same generic weapon, but it had our names on it. And so it's them typing up a card. Right. Nowadays, you would print the card online. The figure would be to you in 2 days. It's no big deal. But so really cool. Thank you very much, Luke, for writing in. And if you want to write in, folks, we'd love to hear about it. Again, anything. And again, now we're in the February of 2019 as we're coming through. And hopefully you guys enjoyed when Luke was on, actually, at the end of the year for your Hunter of the Future. I am still trying to find a movie with as much gravitas as your Hunter of the Future. I think I have a few Luke and I are mulling about, I tell you right now, you go back, if you missed the Your episode, take the time to go back and watch it. You can pick that up on Amazon for $7. And I tell you, that's a good $7. That is an action-packed film the entire way through. As Luke and I were saying with that, you know, we tried to find something different. And I think Dad and I hit a lot of different things this year. We definitely remember last year we started the year off with Theater of Blood and, you know, it's a give over a year ago. And then we hit things like King Kong and like, you know, Dead and Buried and stuff like that. Those kind of different movies throughout the whole year. I mean, King Kong, one of the biggest movies of all time, Dead and Buried, a movie we haven't was lost for, two to three decades. But what are we going to talk about next? Because we've already talked about, you know, we already hit off this year, you know, starting with Deep Star 6, you know, kind of getting getting it out there. Now Vampire Lovers. So what are we going to do for technically our 3-year anniversary? I know we've been on the air in 3 separate years, but now we're at 3 years. So 36 months on the air. We're going to talk about 60th anniversary of The Hideous Sun Demon.
Wow.
And I don't think you get much more different than Vampire Lovers at The Hideous Sun Demon. I mean, there's a love interest in it, but let's be honest, The Hideous Sun Demon, that poor guy's running around in the Arizona heat, wearing all that makeup, sweating like there's no tomorrow, because you know you're sweating, because you see the sweat.
Yeah.
So
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, The Hideous Sun Demon is, and to be honest, when people say, Jay, why did you think about doing it? The Hideous Sun Demon is one of the first movies I thought about when I said, I want to do a podcast about B-movies. And I thought about The Hideous Sun Demon, It the Terror from Beyond Space, Them. I started thinking about like my favorite movies.
Right.
The Hideous Sun Demon is one of my, and again, it may not be a movie that, it may not be one of your favorites. I love The Hideous Sun Demon just for his look. His B-movie look is iconic. You might not know it's him when you see it, but right. The big fangs and the scales. And I did a big head of that, which is one of my first big heads I ever did, and it came out great. And I actually did one of my first models, period, ever.
That's what I was about to say. One of the first models that you ever did, once you got started, was the Hideous Sun Demon.
From Resin from the Grave. Yeah.
And you were upset because your hands were dirty when you were handling his white shirt.
And he grubbed it all up.
And when you look at it, it looks perfect.
Yeah.
Because in the movie, his white shirt is filthy.
Yeah, it's a very Bob Ross. There are no, you know, we don't make just happy accidents. You know, everything has a reason and a purpose. And it actually grunges the shirt up at the time. You got to remember, folks, we're talking, this is around 2000. Like, we're talking, I mean, I've been modeling now, getting close to 20 years. I would know now how to do that. Back then, I had no idea how to grunge up a shirt.
I remember you being upset and said, how am I going to get this white shirt white again?
Yeah.
And I said, it looks good.
Yeah.
So then we put the movie on, and I'll be darned, it would look exactly
the black and white movie, you can tell his shirt is dirty. And they probably only had one shirt. They definitely only had one pair of pants. I'm going to guarantee you they had one pair of pants, because those pants are dirty.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I don't want to give away too much about The Hideous Sun. I mean, we'll be back with that in March. As always, folks, you know, if you got anything feedback-wise, let us know. If you have ideas for the show, let us know. Always be on lookout for specials, because we never know when specials are going to pop up. We will sometimes maybe record a special and just throw it out there to you. And, you know, as we're looking into 2019, There are definitely movies that look at Dad and I are looking at going, wow, we got to cover that, you know, or hey, that's coming up on like, you know, how can this movie already be 10 years old? Or how could this movie be 60 years old? You know, kind of thing.
And besides that, just for us to go to the movies themselves, there's some big time movies coming out.
Yeah, Godzilla is going to be something else. And, you know, for those of you, again, you know, by the time you're listening to this, Godzilla trailer is already old. I mean, it's, you know, kind of thing. But the stuff coming out is just mind blowing. And, you know, we'll see. Again, it's hard for us sometimes to get time to go to a movie, physically go to a movie and go see it. A lot of times I'm going to be watching stuff at home for that reason. But hey, you know, hit us up with stuff. We'd love to hear from you folks. So I think we're good, Dad, right? So until we see you guys at Hideous Sunday, man, keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at TwoTrueFreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!